Today's Teisho will be on case 56 in the Book of Serenity, the Book of Equanimity. Case 56 is entitled Spiritual Uncle Me and the Rabbit. Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Udraka Ramaputra fell from the heavens of the summit of existence into the body of a flying wildcat. Tell me, where is the gain and loss? Case, as Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Mi said, "Swift." Dongshan said, "How?" Mi said, "It's like a commoner being made a prime minister." Dongshan said, "Such a venerable old person still says such words?" Mi said, "Well then, what about you?" Dongshan said, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." Verse, matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet. Jiahui left the country. Zhang Ru crossed the bridge. Zhao and Cao's strategy was able to establish the Han. Chao and Zhu wanted to avoid Yao completely. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Profoundly trust in yourself. In the real state, one mixes tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. This is the first day of spring, of our May 2011 Sesshin, and it just doesn't get any better than this, in my opinion. First of all, well, there are some nice features of this morning. It's a cloudless, beautiful summer day. The sky is absolutely blue, and the air is clean and fresh. The birds are singing, the flowers are in blossom. It's breathtakingly beautiful. And the air temperature is just perfect, right? Not too hot, not too cold. All of those things make this a lovely morning. Even more important is the presence of people who have come here to Sesshin. You know, people got up this morning at 4:30, and they came into the Zendo to do Zazen. And that's really remarkable. You know, many people wouldn't understand what we're doing, and some people who would understand what we're doing wouldn't have the courage or the curiosity, the drive to awaken, that would prompt them to come here. You know, there are people who read lots of books on Zen, and they might come here and say, "No, thank you. It's a little too tough." But there are people like yourselves who have heard the Dharma and who have felt the awakening of bodhicitta, which you might understand as the desire to wake up. Hearing the Dharma, you know, some people experience the bodhicitta, the desire to wake up, and this becomes like a passion. And from the Buddhist standpoint, this is like a very noble impulse, really, the most noble impulse. And when you have bodhicitta arising, you begin to hunger for awakening. And then you decide to come to Sesshin. And it's not necessarily that easy to do three sits in a row the first night and three sits in a row the next morning. and your legs are probably hurting you already, but there's something really majestic about what we're doing. Really majestic. And to meet people who are interested in practicing the way is a great gift in itself. You know, there are 8 million people in New Jersey. Not all of them are interested in practicing the way. Not all of them are have experienced bodhicitta. But you have, and you are here. And that's really wonderful. And all around you, you see people who have the same noble hunger for awakening. And so this is really quite a wonderful thing, to be with people who have this same deep impulse. And the practice itself is really joyous practice, really wonderful. And it may not seem joyous day one or day two. You know, there are challenges. But we've come here to purify body, mind, and heart. And if we persist in this practice, that will happen. And the fruits of that are liberation. Even if you don't achieve a complete awakening at this sesshin, you will achieve liberation if you stay in practice. All these obstacles that we've piled on top of each other gradually are worked through. Maybe not all of them in one sesshin, but one sesshin after another, obstacle after obstacle falls away. And every time an obstacle falls away, we feel more alive. We feel more connected. We feel more whole. And that's what Zen is all about, is working through our obstacles and encountering that connectedness. And Zen is a practice that takes place in the context of a community. So we practice together in one big room. We eat together, and so on and so on. And it's quite a wonderful thing. So that makes the morning really special, right? Beautiful weather, the sky, gentle breeze, singing birds, and this. How wonderful. So today's Teisho is about a case involving the great Zen master Dongshan and his spiritual uncle, Mi. What is a spiritual uncle? A spiritual uncle is like his direct teacher's Dharma brother. So in the case of my first teacher, Genki Roshi, Eido Roshi would be my spiritual uncle. So basically, Dongshan is with his spiritual uncle, and they're walking along, and they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. And Uncle Mi says, "Swift." And Dongshan says, "How?" Dongshan says, "How? How's he swift? How's that rabbit so swift? What makes that rabbit so swift?" Mi says, "It's like a commoner being made a prime minister." So basically, you understand the commoner becoming a prime minister is like, basically, like this. How's the rabbit so swift? He's just a rabbit. But sometimes he can become something more than a rabbit. See, he can become something more than a rabbit. He becomes the universe itself in motion. See, sometimes it's just a rabbit, but sometimes it becomes like pure motion, the universe itself in this little rabbit. And Dongshan says, "You know, you're a great enlightened master, but that's not a very good answer." And Mi says, "Well, then how would you answer it?" And Dongshan says, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." He says, "The rabbit has always been the universe. You know, rabbit is the universe itself, always, every minute." When the Buddha was teaching, somebody came to him and said, "I'm inconsolable. because my child has died, what can you do to set my mind at ease? And the Buddha said, look, I want you to go into the village. I want you to ask if there's any family in the village that hasn't suffered death. And let me know what you find out. And the person went all through the village and asked at every door, every household, and of course found out that everybody had suffered death. And when the person came back to see the Buddha, that person's mind was calm and at ease. Something had happened that brought about that change. This koan is not about death. It's about encountering obstacles, you know? Encountering obstacles. But, you know, there's nobody here in this room, even if you're young, who hasn't experienced disappointments and obstacles that are defeats, we could say. Obstacles and defeats. If I went around the room and said, how many of you have always been successful at everything you did? I doubt very many people would be able to say, oh no, that's me. Right? And indeed, if you were to go through your town and you were to ask people, have you ever encountered failure? I think you would find that everybody who was honest about it would admit to having experienced some kind of a defeat or some kind of a failure. It's a universal human condition. And this koan is really all about that. It's about the experience of getting stuck because something has injured us or disappointed us. And this is quite important, you know. It's easy to, you know, when we think about life, we think about life as pursuing a goal. You know, we think, I'm going to become a doctor. And we think about maybe going to medical school. And so we go to college and we take pre-med courses. And then we take our MCATs. And it's possible that we'll get into medical school. But sometimes we don't get into medical school. See, and this is like an injury in life, right? This is an injury. It's a disappointment or an obstacle. Maybe you you wanted to become a professor. You go to graduate school and you write your dissertation. You get a job, and maybe you write a book, and you spend 6 years writing the book. And the book comes out, and you're waiting for the resounding applause for your 6 years of effort, and you open a magazine and you get a review that's very uncomplimentary. And maybe it's the only review of your book you get, you know, and it's not very flattering. And that's your 6 years' work, right? That's an obstacle. Or, you know, maybe you try out for the team, you know, you go to the Olympic tryouts and you've been practicing every day for years, you know. I was on a swimming team when I was a kid, and there were people who practiced every day without fail, you know, like twice a day as a matter of fact. And they wanted to get onto the Olympic team. And even I went to the Olympic tryouts. And I was, of course, completely defeated by these people. They were so much better than I. And frankly, being an Olympic swimmer never occurred to me. But I still was a member of my team, and we had a pretty good team, and we went to the tryouts. But there were people who had staked years of their life on these tryouts. and then they didn't get onto the Olympic team. And as you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people practiced diligently to be on the Olympic team, but only a handful of people make it to the Olympics, you know. So I had friends of mine who were really disappointed. When I was in high school, I worked very hard on my studies so I could get into a good college. And there was another person in my high school named Andrew. And he worked very hard too. He plugged through calculus and he took physics. And Andrew tried so hard and he got into West Point, which is his dream was to go to West Point. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, but this is the story I heard when I was in college, that Andrew had been accepted to West Point, but that when he got there, he was totally overwhelmed by the curriculum. And he committed suicide. His dream was to go to West Point, finish, be an officer. And as his dream fell apart, he just couldn't, he got so depressed and he committed suicide. You know, these kind of things happen, you know. We all experience defeats or disappointments. And they have the effect sometimes of blocking us, creating a block. You know, where we feel we can't go forward, can't go back, and we can't go forward. This is like a very elementary human experience. You know. Things in life create these blocks, right? Where there are things we just can't do. You know, when I was a kid, I lived in a very tough neighborhood. You know, my parents rented an apartment in a part of Baltimore that was really tough. And when I went to school, I was a very protected little kid. And my mother and father, didn't really pay much attention to what was happening in the neighborhood. So when they sent me to school, my mother sent me to school in these clothes that were just ridiculous. They were very elegant clothes. And she sent me to school in these clothes that looked like something out of a British fashion magazine. And I went to this elementary school where all the kids wore blue jeans and they were really tough. And it was like going to school with a target on my back, you know. So I actually, you know, got into a fight my first day at school. And I had never been in fights, you know. I just didn't know how to fight. And, of course, somebody really beat me up. So, you know, it became very hard for me to go to school because I was always afraid that when I went to school I would have to fight. And indeed, I would often have to fight. And I think it had a lasting effect on my personality, you know. But we all have these experiences, right? You know, things that block us. Later, when I was older, I used to have a hard time when I was in college relating to other people. And I began to make some friends in high school, but not very many. And when I got to college, at first I was very reserved. It was hard for me to make friends. And I think it all goes back to that experience in Baltimore. You know, where I was always getting into fights. And I learned to hang back and be very reserved. I was blocked, you know. And in college, I started making some friends. I learned how to make friends. But it was very hard for me because I had this block that I was trying to work through. And I think it was also very, very hard for me to interact with women. I guess I saw myself as a bit of a loser. And so it was difficult for me to be confident with women at college, you know. I think I was still worried about getting beaten up, you know, even though that's preposterous. Blocked. We all have these blocks, you know. By the time we're adults, we've acquired a lot of these blocks, you know, and we get new ones. We get blocked in new ways, you know. You try to go to medical school, but your MCAT score is not good enough. You know, you write an article, and it gets rejected by a publishing company or a magazine. You know, you apply to a graduate program, and they turn you down. And you know, these experiences are so fundamentally human, right? Disappointment. Is such a human thing, but it adds up. Over time, we become hesitant or paralyzed even. We become inflexible and unchanging, you know. There's a lot of people in the world who have, everybody has had defeats. Everybody has had painful experiences, and they can become these blocks that people just can't get out of, right? They can't break free from them. And this is, believe it or not, even though this koan sounds like it's about a little white rabbit, it's really about the rabbit's ability to be swift, to move, to go freely wherever it wants to go. You know, they're walking along, they see a rabbit, and the rabbit encounters a danger and immediately responds. There's no hesitation. The rabbit doesn't have self-doubt, right? The rabbit doesn't go, oh my God, you know, am I going to be fast enough? You know, I might not be fast enough. Other rabbits are faster than I am. What chance do I have? You know, I'm doomed, you know. They don't think that way, right? Just natural responsiveness. Natural responsiveness, automatic. The rabbit sees the danger and runs. And runs, you know, the rabbit doesn't run half-heartedly. The rabbit doesn't run the rabbit doesn't run with self-doubt. The rabbit doesn't start off going, oh, I'll never be able to get away. You know, he's surely going to eat me, right? The rabbit doesn't do that, or at least this rabbit didn't do it, you know. And the rabbit doesn't go, oh, I'm no good at running, you know. The rabbit just runs with its wholeheartedly, right? Its unreserved action. This kind of spontaneity is easy for rabbits, but hard for humans, because we are injured, and because we sometimes become blocked. But the spontaneity of the rabbit is a reminder to us that we don't have to be blocked. We don't have to be arrested. We don't have to be there's a naturalness to our existence which we can get in touch with. That is like a medicine, because it restores us to our natural condition, you see. And so, you know, even though we have these experiences, everybody, of defeat and disappointment. And, you know, basically, you try this, and somebody says, no, not good enough. You try that, and somebody says, I'm sorry, you know, we'll get back to you, you know. You take your MCATs, you know. My friend Larry Sullivan, who I went hiking with last year, told me about this experience he had. He actually is a pretty good trial lawyer in a small town. He works in Eastern Oregon, and he's a city attorney for a number of cities out there that are small, really small towns. And he, earlier in his career, he did a lot of trial law. And he thought he was getting really good at it. And then he said he went into trial, and he said there was this lawyer, he said, who just kicked my ass. You know, he was just astounded. The guy was so good. And it was hard for my friend to get over that defeat, you know, because he had begun to think, you know, I'm on a roll. I'm a good lawyer. I'm actually a pretty good trial lawyer. You know, I'm winning these cases. I'm eloquent. You know, I persuade the jury. And this guy, he said, came in and made mincemeat out of him. And my friend Larry said it was very hard after that, you know, it was hard to have confidence in himself, have faith in himself. You know, my friend Larry told me something else about this lawyer who kicked his ass. So the lawyer who kicked his ass was like everybody thought was going to be this really great lawyer. But at some point, he just decided he didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. And he went to Italy and studied bread making and pizza making. This is true. This is a true story. And he came back from Italy and he started a company in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that made artisanal, what's called artisanal pizzas. You've probably never heard of artisanal pizzas, but they're traditional Italian pizza. And he came back from Italy and he built a traditional Italian pizza oven, which is not like an American pizza oven. And he made traditional Italian pizza, which is not like our New York-style pizza with an inch of bread and 4 inches of stuff, including cheese. And it's simple bread with some sauce on it, you know. And the bread actually is burned. It's burned at the edges. So it's brown or a dark black. It's not bitter tasting. It's very sweet. But anyway, he started cranking out these artisanal pizzas. And they went like hotcakes. You know, they sold like hotcakes. He was very successful. He had this very successful restaurant business. And then he was so successful, he sold it. And now he's got another, he went into some other food business. And he learned something else. And you know, I think that's so interesting. That guy had flexibility. He had resilience, you know. It's true, he won the case. He didn't lose the case that my friend was involved with. But he met somebody, Larry met somebody who was able to be flexible, who was like a rabbit. You know, he's a successful lawyer, then he doesn't want to be a lawyer. And he tries something totally new. Now, you know, he must have had failures too. You know, he didn't go from victory to victory, but he's got that flexibility or resilience, you know. So, you know, most of us lose a lot of that flexibility or resilience as we're moving through life. Especially, you know, to tell you the truth, some people are very sensitive, you know, we're sensitive. So, you know, when I was a little kid, I remember going to next door and people would be playing and I'd say, "Can I play too?" And some of the kids would go, "Ah, no, you know, you're no good, get out of here." And, you know, if you have a certain kind of personality, you go, "Screw you, you know, I want to play." And usually people go, "Okay, you can play." But people would say that to me and I would think, "Oh man, I'm going to go home." You know? So, you know, maybe you're like that. Maybe you have that kind of personality where you just, you come and you go, "Hey, can I play?" And they go, "No, beat it." And you go, "Okay, I'll beat it." No. So maybe you're like that, you know. But, you know, if you're more resilient, that's good, but you might not be. And Zen is about learning how to be resilient, learning how to be resilient. The Zen idea is that if you want to be resilient, get in touch with your true nature, your true nature. So, you know, you don't really have one self. You know, you have many different selves. When you're with your family, you're a certain kind of a person. When you're at school, you're a certain kind of a person. Even when you're by yourself alone, you know, you're different people. You are. You know, sometimes you're by yourself and you're full of self-doubt. Sometimes you're by yourself and you're king of the universe. Sometimes you're by yourself and you're lonely, sometimes you're by yourself, you know, you have many different selves. But the Zen idea is that there's a level of consciousness, or there's a dimension of life which is without barriers, and it's without obstacles. And this is like a natural life, This is what we call in Zen, this is living from your true nature. And the experience of true nature is actually an experience of selflessness. So basically, when you are in very deep concentration, a lot of thinking begins to begins to cease. And you begin to experience the moment in a very unself-conscious way. You know, you're not thinking about yourself at all. You're just immersed in the flow of moments from moment to moment. It's like, you know, we're thinking, I. And then you keep watching the breath, or you keep calling mu, and eventually the mind that says I begins to quiet down. And you begin to become connected to the flow of moments, moment by moment, moment by moment. And a self-consciousness almost disappears. Every once in a while you might say, oh, I'm doing pretty well. But even that thought might not come up very often. You're just so absorbed in the flow of events, right, from moment to moment. This state of mind, this condition of being, is really very, very important from the Zen standpoint. This is the liberated state of mind, in which you're flowing along from moment to moment without any judgment. And also, when there's no judgment, you'll notice that fear goes away. And the obstacles become unimportant. See, so basically, this is, from the Zen standpoint, the most liberated condition. Basically an empty mind, no clinging, no self, and flowing with the moment. And you become like a rabbit, like that fleet rabbit. See, nothing can stop you. Nothing can arrest you because you're just moving moment to moment to moment to moment. You're one with the flow. And this is the Zen view of liberation. Okay? There's other views of liberation, and they're not necessarily incorrect. So if you're a rabbit who feels bad about your running style, you can go to a running coach. Maybe there's another rabbit who gives rabbits instructions on how to run better. You know, and you can go and say, I just can't, you know, I can't get up enough speed, you know. And maybe the rabbit says, well, you have to pull your legs up more tightly, you know. Or you need to, you know, clean your claws more carefully. Maybe there's a rabbit who says, well, you know, let's talk about your childhood. You know, there were 8 other bunnies, you know, mom didn't pay much attention to you. You were always the last one to get fed, you know, you got the old grass, you always got the old grass. The other bunnies ate the flowers and you just got the stalks, you know. So naturally you don't think well of yourself, you know, you think you were the bunny mom didn't love. And that would help too. That would be good. You know, you say, yeah, I'm as good as those other bunnies. You know? Or maybe mom was so busy with 8 bunnies, she just didn't have time. She didn't dislike me. She didn't know what she was doing at the time. You know, so those are good strategies too. They're good. They help. But the Zen strategy is those are good. But there's a dimension of yourself which has no name and has no birth and no death. It is not named Kurt. It is not named Bill. It does not win awards, you know. It doesn't lose awards. You know, every year they give awards, like for the best. I'm always amazed. Awards are really not a good idea, in my opinion. I hope you win an award for your own sake, because it's so gratifying. And if you're nominated for an award, I think you should go and receive it. But on the whole, I think they're not such a good idea. You know, every year people make movies. You know, they make movies, and some of the movies are just great. But only one person can get, you know, best film for the year. And it's so unfair, right? I mean, it's phony to say they're all good. You know, that's not true. Some of them aren't good. Some of them are so-so. But, you know, there's not just one good movie every year. There's one best film of this year. You know, that's just preposterous. And so everybody leaves the Academy Awards going, oh, I'm a loser. You know, there'll be like a handful of people who go, ah, I'm the winner. And there'll be a hand, you know, but everybody else goes home and goes, ah, what a loser I am. You know, that's crazy. But you have a self which isn't, which can't get any awards, and it can't lose any awards. It has no birth and it has no death. And by the way, it's totally connected to the moment without judgment. And this is a dimension of yourself which is well worth cultivating, because it is quite wonderful to be in that state and quite healing. And it really does help people to overcome barriers. You know? The other strategies are good too, and these can be used in tandem. You know, but they're a little different because, you know, Zen is about, it's important to feel good about yourself. It's important to have a self that you want to inhabit. You know, so sometimes people have given you images of yourself that you need to get rid of. They're destructive images. And you want to get rid of them. But it's also helpful to realize that you have a self which has no images, which can't be represented, which doesn't have a beginning or an end. And this is very, very liberating. And the Zen view is this is where we go to free ourselves from our bonds, our obstacles. There's a strategy, you know, if you go and say, can I play? And somebody says, no, you can't play. You could go home and you could say, well, you know, they said I couldn't play. And maybe somebody could say, go back there and say, I want to play. And you could do that. Maybe they'll let you play. Or somebody could say, well, you know, why do you want to play with them anyway? They're a bunch of idiots, you know. And you could feel better that way. And that's valid too. But then, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you enter this deep state of mind, and you enter this mushing, this empty mind, and you're in the flow, and it's as though the whole universe is unfolding through you. Or rather, it's as though you yourself are one with the universe as it unfolds. This is a really glorious state of being, and it's very highly valued in Zen. And when you feel that way, you feel young, you feel energetic, optimistic, you feel fearless, you feel indestructible, you feel alive, you feel eternally alive, and this is the secret, you know, really, of Zen practice. I'm always amazed at how resilient some people are. You know, some people just are really resilient. It's amazing. You know, when I read biographies of people, what they go through, you know, business people who have lost, you know, they've gone bankrupt 3 or 4 times and they just keep plugging away. It doesn't seem to bother them. And I must say, I envy that resilience. You know, I think they're able to occupy their lives very lightly. You know, some people take everything so seriously. Everything is like life and death. And then, you know, there are these people who are able to go through life and death, and they're very lighthearted about it. You know, they're very lighthearted. It doesn't seem to stick. And I think some of those people are very insensitive and egotistical, but some people are very flexible and very resilient. You know, they don't hold on to these things. They just keep going. They're in the next moment. They're in the next moment. These things that, events that would flatten some people don't flatten them. You know, and in Zen, this kind of condition of being like that is highly, highly valued. You know, the great Zen teacher who brought sent to China, the great teacher was an Indian monk named Bodhidharma. And when Bodhidharma was quite famous in India, and he went to China, and he was given an interview with the emperor of China. And the interview was a disaster. If you've had a bad job interview, think about what happened to Bodhidharma. He went for this interview, and basically, if he had impressed the emperor of China, the emperor would have built a temple for him, you know, maybe a university, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they had this disastrous encounter where the emperor didn't understand a word that Bodhidharma was saying. And Bodhidharma left, and he went up and lived in a cave near the Shaolin Temple. And he sat by himself for 9 years, and finally some students showed up, and two men and a woman. And these became the foundation of Zen practice in China. And, you know, after the interview, Bodhidharma could have said, "Oh man, I really blew that interview. You know, when he asked me what Zen was about, why did I say vast emptiness? You know, I should have just said, getting better every day," or something like that. Right? Better and better every day. You know? But instead I told him vast emptiness. Now look where I am. Nowhere. You know? I'm going back to India. This is too discouraging. Or, you know, he could have, you know, and he goes up in the cave. "Oh, I'm stuck in this crappy cave. I could be in a palace right now. If only I'd said the right thing, you know. What an idiot I am," right? You know. So Bodhidharma sat and did Piquan. He did sitting in front of a wall, the wall of Mu, for 9 years. And he could have gone out of the cave every day and gone, "God damn, by myself, I could have had hundreds of students by now, you know." But he didn't beat himself up. How did he avoid it? You know? Moment by moment concentration. He just unified himself with the flow of events, right? And one day, you know, this guy shows up and becomes his student, and then two other people show up. And, you know, and he could have gone, "Oh my God, all I've got is three students, you know, a lifetime of work and three lousy students, you know. I know monks who have thousands of students, you know." But then look what happened. You know, it all worked out okay. I mean, there is a kind of mind that is judging and comparing and that has an image of how things should turn out. You know, he should have gone to the emperor. The emperor should have said, "My God, man, you're a genius. You know, name whatever you want. You know, I'll do it." You know, and that could have happened. You know, it didn't happen. And Bodhidharma didn't let it bother him. You know, you really don't control things. We wish we controlled them so much. We want to control them so much that we actually blame ourselves for things we can't control. You know, I was just reading that something like 75% of college graduates are living with their parents now. They go to college, and they're living with their parents. Because the job situation is so terrible and wages are so low and there are these rotten internships, which is a total scam, right? When you got out of college, you used to get a low-paying job. For a while, I worked in a newspaper for $80 a week, right? But at least I got it paid. I got a check, you know. You know, now it's called an internship and you pay to work there almost. You know, it's like, well, you can work here, you get something on your CV, but don't expect a check. You know, it's really a rotten deal. But anyway, a lot of these people who get out of college, they've done a good job, they're on a job search, there's nothing out there sometimes, you know, for a while, and they blame themselves. And that's crazy, right? I think what's so frightening, the reason people would rather blame themselves, they blame themselves rather than admit that a great deal of what happens is out of our control. See, so the biggest fear is having no control. That's the biggest fear. So when we would rather say, "Oh my God, I'm an idiot," you know, or "Why did I do this to myself? Why did I choose this major? Why did I," you know, we'd rather do that than say, "Look, I have no control." Because the biggest fear is to say, "I have no control." But see, the Zen idea is, don't worry about that. Just be one with the moment, because you have very little control indeed. So harmonize yourself with the flow. You're much more likely to be creative, to be responsive, to be alert, to be happy, to be healthy, if you stop beating yourself up and you become one with the flow. You know, you didn't cause the financial collapse of 2008, right? I don't think. If you did, please raise your hand, you know. But you didn't. So it's not your fault the job market's in the toilet, right? So being actually realistic about this and saying, there's a lot I don't control. How will I deal with the lack of control? I will harmonize, I will empty myself out, and I will harmonize myself with the universe. That's the Zen strategy. You can take it or leave it, but that's how we deal with things. That's our way. We empty the self and harmonize yourself with the unfolding of the universe from this moment to next moment. See? And then you're like the rabbit. You know, you're swift and unobstructed. You're not crippled by self-doubt and second-guessing. This is so important, so important. So it's just another reason to be happy to be here, right? Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. This is the koan starts out by saying it's better to go to hell, actually, forever, than to try to be a saint. See? Devadatta was the Buddha's cousin, his evil cousin. You probably don't know this, but the Buddha organized, when the Buddha started teaching, people began to study with him and became the Sangha. But the Buddha had a cousin named Devadatta who was terribly jealous of him, of the Buddha. And after a while, Devadatta began to say to people, you know, Siddhartha isn't really the top. He's not the best. I'm the best. I, Devadatta, am the real Buddha, you know. And then nobody believed him. They all thought, come on, Devadatta, you're an asshole. then he decided to kill the Buddha. He decided to assassinate him. Really, that's really happened. So I'll be the Buddha no matter what. I'll kill Siddhartha. You know, I'll have him executed. And then they'll have to accept me. You know, it's so crazy. So he said, but they said, so Devadatta is a bad guy in Buddhism, is the point. You know, he screwed up. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Now, Udraka Ramaputra was the Buddha's teacher. Udraka Ramaputra we are all the students of Udraka Ramaputra also. He was a great meditation master. He was the one who discovered Mu. See, he's great. I have the highest regard for him. He discovered Mu. And the Buddha encountered emptiness through Udraka Ramaputra, but then the Buddha said, you know, emptiness itself is not the highest. It's not enlightenment. It helps, but it's not there. But the point is, the bad guy is in bliss, and Udraka Ramaputra fell from heaven, and it entered the body of a flying wildcat. Who knows what that is, but it's something bad. Okay, it's like a bad animal. So look, this is not fair. The bad guy is in heaven, and the good guy is stuck in the body of a wildcat. You know, what kind of a universe is this? Ah, it's our universe. Don't you recognize it? It's unfair, right? Good guys are always rewarded. We know that's true. Bad guys always punished, right? That's how it works. Never, never, right? Universe isn't necessarily fair, right? It's not necessarily fair. In fact, very rarely, as a matter of fact. So how do you avoid, how do you deal with that? The universe isn't fair. What do? You could be depressed, you could beat yourself. Usually we beat ourselves up, we loathe ourselves, we feel inferior, etc., etc. But actually, the Zen way is to say, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to empty myself out and harmonize myself with the universe. As Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run in front of them. Mi said, swift, unobstructed. Dongshan said, yes, but how? Mi said, It's like a commoner being made into a prime minister. In other words, a humble rabbit can rise to the level of enlightened mind and be free. And Dongshan said, you know, you're a great Zen master, but you just don't have it yet. And he said, well, so what would you say? And he said, you were enlightened from the beginning. Your fundamental nature is free. The chains that we construct are invented, right? We are basically free, right? We're basically free. We create these mental obstacles, and then we drape ourselves with chains that we ourselves have invented. Did your business go broke? Yes. Did you try? Yes. Why are you worried about it? Screw it. Screw it. See? It's not your fault. Why punish yourself for something you couldn't control? You know, every once in a while people let themselves off the hook and they're so happy. It's like, by God, you're right. That's not my fault. I've done a good job. I'm a good boy. I'm a good girl. You know? And then, you know, you sit on the cushion, you empty the mind, you feel connected, the birds are singing, the air is blowing on your face. It's as though the whole universe is unfolding through you. But you're the universe. You know? Your fundamental nature is this stainless, indestructible energy. Generations of nobility, sometimes up, sometimes down, always here. Verse, matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet. If you can be in this mind, it can be snow and frost, clouds and sleet, defeat on the battlefield, victory on the battlefield. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Profoundly trust in, it says, favor and disgrace are both favor and disgrace. Victory and defeat are disturbing. See, how could victory be disturbing? But victory is as corrupting as defeat. It really is. From the Zen standpoint, to hold on to victory is just as bad as to hold on to defeat. Neither one is good for you. Don't think in terms of gain and loss, right and wrong. Such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. See? We don't worry about gain and loss, right and wrong. We just worry about harmonizing with this beautiful moment. So let's forget the self. Sit on the cushion and forget the self. And be one with the universe as it moves from one moment to the next.